Hey everyone, if you would kindly take your seats. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all to this lecture, which is co-sponsored by UOS and our adult education program, and Torah in Motion. Torah in Motion is an organization out of Toronto. UOS is an organization out of Houston. Torah in Motion promotes the study of Torah and open thinking by sponsoring numerous events which are held in Toronto and are virtually, by virtue of the use of technology, held all over the world as well. And I'm very grateful that Torah in Motion asked UOS to partner with them in bringing Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber to Houston. Before I introduce Rabbi Sperber, I want to point out that this lecture is very generously underwritten by Dr. Lewis and Sheila Train in memory of Sheila's sister and brother-in-law, Ruth and Rabbi Joseph Kelman. I wanted to ask Sheila to come forward for a moment to say a word about her sponsorship, and then we'll move on with the introduction of Dr. Sperber.
I want to thank you all for coming. Gives me great pleasure for my dear husband Lewis and I to sponsor this lecture with Rabbi Sperber in memory of my dear sister, Rabbitson Ruth Kelman, and her husband, Rabbi Joe Kelman, both of blessed memory. And as Rabbi Gelman told you, this is under the auspices of UOS and Torah in Motion. And my nephew, Rabbi Jay Kelman, is in charge of the CEO of Torah in Motion. And with the kindness of Rabbi Gelman working together with my nephew, we have the privilege of bringing Rabbi Sperber down. And I'd like to think that both my dear sister, Ruth, and her husband, Joe, are looking down on us as we study Torah, which is all what they lived for. So thank you all for being here.
Once again, thank you, Sheila and Lou, very much for your generous sponsorship. We tried to keep it simple, so we're working with Rabbi Gelman and Rabbi Kelman. And that way, it's not too confusing. And it's really a good shidduch, Sheila, as you mentioned, between your family and Jay and the shul, and all the pieces fell into place so beautifully. And this, indeed, is a wonderful way to honor their memory. My dear friends, tonight is really a unique treat as we welcome Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber. Rabbi Sperber is the president of the Machon HaGavoa LeTorah at Bar Ilan University. He is an expert in classical philology, history of Jewish customs, Jewish art history, Jewish education, and Talmudic studies. He is the author of numerous works in Jewish law, custom, and theology, including Minhagei Yisrael, Origins and History on the Character and Evolution of Jewish Customs. Very recently, Rabbi Sperber published a book on Jewish liturgy and the potential for change within Jewish liturgy. Rabbi Sperber has penned countless articles on issues related to halakha and ethics and the interplay of halakha and modernity. Rabbi Sperber is sought after for his halachic rulings, for his advice, for his etzah, and perhaps most importantly, Rabbi Sperber is a wonderfully accessible rav, and it is rare that a rav of Rav Sperber's stature and someone who is as busy and sought after as Rabbi Sperber is as accessible and open to speaking to just about anyone who manages to track him down. I've had the privilege of learning with and from Dr. Sperber now for many years. Many of you are aware of the fact that I'm a vegetarian, but most of you are probably not aware of the fact that it's Rabbi Sperber's fault. Many years ago at a rabbinic conference on kashrut, which was not just about the X's and O's of halachic kashrut, but about ecological kashrut, if you will, and kashrut of the environment, Dr. Sperber got up to speak, and one of the first things out of his mouth was, I've been a vegetarian for over 40 years, or something along those lines. And I had always been toying with the idea. And at that lunch, which was 4 years ago in February, I did not have any meat or fish on the menu. And since then, I also haven't had any meat or fish. So I'll tell you, Dr. Sperber, that most people in this room didn't think I'd make it this far. So it's a tribute to your inspiration that day. So I thank you for helping me get over the hump and for all of the other opportunities I've had to learn with you. And it's indeed a great personal pleasure and a great honor for our congregation to welcome you. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber.
Birshut Harav or Rabbanim Mareder Atra. With the permission of the distinguished rabbis of this congregation, I also would like to thank Rabbi Gelman for inviting me here, for making this possible, and to, of course, the family who sponsored this lecture. I also knew Rabbi Gelman and his late wife from Toronto, and Rabbi Jay Kelman is actually a former student of mine. So everything is coming together, as it were. I think officially the title of this talk was Dynamism versus Traditionalism in Halakha. This is actually a very complex issue. Complex and problematic from many points of view. I think the first I think the first we have to be very keenly aware of something that's terribly obvious but somehow seems to be largely forgotten, and that is that some very radical changes have taken part over the last century. If you just think about it, women weren't allowed to be doctors less than a century ago. They could be witch doctors, but they couldn't be doctors. They couldn't study in a university. People were not very mobile. They lived in their towns, they lived in their villages, in the shtetlach, and they may have never left them throughout their lifetime. There was very little international communication. Women were largely uneducated. I don't mean that they were not only not allowed to be doctors, but they didn't have any real education. They were housebound. Many of you know about the famous book, A Room of One's Own. It was written in the late 19th century, which in a sense encapsulates the situation of women up till the second quarter of the 20th century. So there have been radical changes in the world of general, and there's been radical changes in the Jewish world. Obviously, there have been historical changes, the Holocaust, the rapture of European Jewry, the destruction of whole communities, the disruption of family life, the mobility that came about as a result of the Holocaust, and perhaps even going back before that to the First World War. The eradication of a whole generation of the people who constituted the Jewish religious and spiritual leadership, which means basically the rupture of tradition. On the other hand, of course, a new political reality. For the first time in 2 millennia, the Jews had a sovereign state of their own. All these changes had a variety of very deep implications. Complex sociological, ideological, political, and religious implications. The modern society, the world in which we live, the world in which there's great mobility, free communication, a great deal of liberalism, a world of permissiveness, a world in which there's new notions of morality, what's called relativism in morality, in which it's not very clear what's right and what's wrong, in which each society will make its own decisions of what's ethically acceptable or unacceptable. The breakdown of the family unit, alternative life styles, all these things present a tremendous challenge to traditional Judaism. So, one of the responses, one of the possible responses, is a retreat into some sort of ghettoization of Jewish society. We cannot accept the changes that are taking place. We cannot permit ourselves to be influenced by modern liberal ideas, by sexual permissiveness, by moral relativism. And all such aspects of modernity are dangerous to the preservation of our traditional way of life. I remember many years ago, still before Glasnost, that I came to Kiev, now Ukraine, then Soviet Russia. And I went to the synagogue, and which was empty, but the doors were open. And I went upstairs, there was a sort of a second story, and I saw a fellow lying there on a bench, sort of asleep, dressed in a black garment, with a black kippah on his head, a black jacket like I'm wearing actually, looking a bit bedraggled. And I came up and I sort of said, "What are you doing here?" And he told me that he was sent to save the Jewish community. And I said to him, "Where are you from?" He said to me, Ich bin von Squaretown. I'm from Squaretown. So I said, oh, in that case, you probably speak English. He says, nein, ich bin von Squaretown. I don't speak any English, just Yiddish. A Squaretown is a ghetto, which is trying to preserve the atmosphere, the ambiance, the way of life of early 19th century Eastern Europe. And the people are dressed as they did then, and they behave in that fashion, and they educate their children in that fashion, and they only speak Yiddish, which means that they can't really interact with the modern world. So that's one type of response. Now that particular response, which we might call traditionalism or outer traditionalism or outer orthodoxy or Haredism, all these terms really are overlapping, have also their ideological sources that go back to the 19th century, to the early 19th century. In the early 19th century, there was a new trend that was developing in Germany and Hungary. That was the Reform Movement. The Reform Movement began in the late 18th, the early 19th century. And the Reform Movement threatened Orthodox Judaism. It threatened it on an ideological and on a halachic basis. It challenged the legitimacy and the veracity of customs, minagim, because normally they don't really have any real source. They were willing to reinterpret biblical verses, which would give rise to a completely different interpretation of halachot. They were, to a large extent, assimilationists. And the great leaders of German Reform Movement were even involved in writing the history of the last generation of Jews. He who knows the real reason why Goetz wrote his great history, or why Schleiermacher wrote his classic bibliographies of Jewish and Hebrew writings, knew that they were documenting the end of the Jewish people as Jews. So there was this movement which gained ascendancy, and in the 19th century there was also a considerable degree of assimilation and of people turning to Christianity, Jews turning to Christianity. And so the leaders of the religious communities, and at their head, at their helm, the Chatam Sofer, living in Presburg, attacked vociferously the Reform rabbis, who were also altering the liturgy. And the Chatam Sofer coined a phrase, a very clever and subtle one. In Hebrew, Chadash Asur Bina Torah. Anything that is new and innovative is forbidden by the Torah. Now, the original meaning of that particular phrase is completely different. It has a different context. It refers to the new harvest, which is forbidden before the Omer was separated in the period of the Second Temple, shortly after Pesach. Chadash, Tvuah Chadasha, Asura Min HaTorah. But the Chatam Sofer used it in the sense that innovation from the innovators, HaMechadshim, who were the reformers, reforming is innovating, Asur min haTorah. And this generated a good deal of literature, of halachic literature. And for example, he stated that using vernacular, non-Hebrew, in the service was asur min haTorah, forbidden by the Torah. That moving the bima from the center of the synagogue closer to the Aron HaKodesh, which is what the Reform movement did, making it more similar to architectonically to a church, asur min haTorah, wearing rabbinic garments, special rabbinic garments, was asur min haTorah. Obviously, these things are not asur min haTorah, but this was chadash asur min haTorah. Any type of innovation, since it was dangerous, erosive of the Orthodox Jewish community, was asur min haTorah, forbidden. Now, the Chatam Sofer had a tremendous influence in his geographic sphere of Germany, Hungary, parts of Eastern Europe. And his disciples, his followers, continued in this line of Chadash Asur min haTorah, of what we might call ultra-traditionalism. The Ksav Sofer, the Chatan Sofer, and other such giants of halakha. Moving into the 20th century, where the same ideological and halachic justification for preserving tradition as it was continued, and in generations closer to ours, the Mishneh Berurah, the Chofetz Chaim, writing around the turn of the 20th century. The Mishneh Berurah was written between 1893 and 1910. And just to give you an example, just so you should understand it, the Mishneh Berurah, the Chofetz Chaim's son, has a book of memoirs, and he writes there that his father was against electricity in the synagogue. Not on Shabbat. In general. Why? Chadash asur min haTorah. It was something that was new. It was an innovation. Our parents and our grandparents never had electricity. In the takanot, in the bylaws of the community of Mattersdorf, there are some very interesting statements. Northern Eastern Europe is very cold in winter. Even colder than Houston. And even colder than New York. The descriptions of synagogal life in the communities, in the various communities around Mattersdorf, they write how the rabbi used to come in the morning, and by the end of the service, his beard was a solid lump of ice. And in the winter, they couldn't get a minyan other than by paying people to come because it was so cold. So somebody made a suggestion around 1911, this is not so long ago, that they should introduce fireplaces into the synagogue. They never had it before, and presumably they didn't have it because most of the synagogues were wooden synagogues. And the answers that were given by the rabbis of Mattersdorf was Chadash Asur min haTorah. Our forefathers never had a heater in the synagogue, so we will not have a heater in the synagogue. And again, from Mattersdorf, they didn't have seats like you're sitting on in the synagogue. They had shtenderim. And you had to stand for the whole service. They didn't have benches. And you can imagine on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when the service is very long, even longer than it is here, went on for the whole day and sometimes for the whole night. Elderly people, it's very difficult to stand. It's difficult for young people to stand for many hours. So somebody suggested in a very innovative fashion to introduce benches, safsalim, into the synagogue. Rabbis forbade it. Chadash asur min haTorah. Our forefathers never had benches in their synagogues. You will not have it. These are a reductio ad absurdum of this outer traditional fashion. But the phrase had a tremendous power. And though it was taken out of its original context and applied to situations which the Chatam Sofer wouldn't have dreamt of, nonetheless, it continued. And it continued even into the period of the Chazon Ish, which is up to the 50s of the 20th century, where he continued to use the argument of the danger of making any sort of changes in the traditional way of life, in minhagim, in halachot, in dress. And all could be justified. Justified by quoting the Chatam Sofer, justified by quoting the Midrashim that talk about the Jews, the Bnei Israel, I should say more correctly, in Egypt, who didn't change during the period of captivity in Egypt, that they didn't change their names, they didn't change their language, they didn't change their clothes. And this created a certain stream in Judaism, a certain stream which started off, in a sense, with the fight against reform movement, continues into the late 20th century onwards in the need to protect oneself against the dangers of modernity and modern society and modern culture does present an enormous number of challenges to Orthodox Judaism. And there was a sort of a coalition of the Chadash Asur Min haTorah, East European, Hungarian, Chug Chatam Sofer ideology, and the emergent Haredi society that was actually probably to a large extent the result of the activity and influence of the Chazon Ish. Now, in practical terms, this created a situation where the halakha turned to stringency, to chumrah, in order to create a barrier against the dangers of modernity. Chomat hadat, the walls of religion. And anybody that sought to make new innovatory ideas would be bringing a breach in the Chomat Hadat. Pirtza, the Chomat Hadat. If you think of a picture of a city that's being surrounded by enemies, and you protect yourself because the walls are massive, any breach in that wall will endanger the population. This is the sort of picture, the metaphor that we're speaking of. As a consequence, the changes in society, the changes in the status of women, the changes in the degree of education, of general education, the fact of mobility, all these things were not taken into account. The fact that people moved from one city to another, left their parents or lost their parents, and didn't have a continuity of tradition, and were seeking to build up for themselves new modes of behavior, of life. This was not taken into account. Quite the contrary. From the point of view of the ultra-religious, ultra-traditionalist stream, all these people had to be assimilated into that traditional society. That's one of the reasons why a great portion of the so-called Baal Tshuva movement have moved into the Alter Haredi camp. I don't like generalizations, but this is also a fairly accurate picture of what's going on. Now, the ideological picture emerging from this oversimplified but complex historical and sociological development created a certain situation in which the halakha, for the main part, became paralyzed, became inflexible. Maybe with the exception of certain changes in technology. So when new situations arose, whether they be technological or whether they be ideological or political or sociological, they were largely ignored. The State of Israel is something that's unacceptable, according to Satmar, as I think I don't need to tell you. And again, they have their sources and their justifications. The emancipation of women has virtually no expression in the ultra-religious communities. And it's a very tragic situation. So, is the halakha really, of its very nature, something that's stagnant, something that's inflexible, something that's become petrified? Or is the halakha really a very dynamic system? And let me read to you a couple of quotations. The one is by a great Sfaradi rabbi, Rab Ben Sion Meir Chai Uziel, died in 1953. No, we're not talking about the distant past. He writes, in each generation, the conditions of life, the changes in values, the discoveries of technology and science bring about new questions and problems that require solutions. We cannot close our eyes to these questions and say innovation is forbidden by the Torah, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. That is, that anything not explicitly mentioned by our forefathers is to be considered prohibited. Another great Sfaradi Rav, who died recently in 1988, was the Rav Rashi of Tel Aviv, Chaim David Alevi, wrote, as it is extremely clear, obviously he didn't write in English, as it is extremely clear that no law or edict can maintain its position over a long period of time due to the changes in the conditions of life, and that laws which were good in their time are no longer suitable after a generation or more, but require correction or change, how is it that our Holy Torah gave us righteous and upright laws and edicts thousands of years ago, and we continue to act in accordance with them to this very day? How is it that these same laws were good in their time and are good to this very day as well? Such a thing is only possible because the sages of Israel were given permission in every generation to innovate in matters of halakha in accordance with the changing times and situations. It's only by virtue of this that the existence of the Torah has been possible in Israel, and that they were able to follow in the ways of the Torah and mitzvot. Anybody who thinks that the halakha is frozen and that one is not permitted to deviate from it right or left is very much mistaken. On the contrary, there is nothing as flexible as the halakha. And then he gives examples. And it's only by virtue of the flexibility of halakha that the Jewish people have been able, by virtue of the numerous and useful innovations that were introduced by Jewish sages over the generations, to follow in the way of Torah and mitzvot for thousands of years. In yet another passage written by the great Rav Kook Zitzal, he writes, heaven forbid that we should think that by permitting that which is permitted, because it didn't exist in reality in the past, the custom of prohibiting it should apply. In other words, he's saying that because something didn't appear in the past, it doesn't mean that it mustn't appear in the present or the future. On the contrary, when people see that we permit that which is permitted, then they will believe more strongly that that which we prohibit is done because indeed it is the law of the Torah. But if we prohibit even those things that have come about by ways of new invention, which never existed before, they will say that the rabbis wish to be strict on their own whim and don't take care or pity for the public. And therefore we will allow room for greater breaches. May God protect us. So he's saying that it's not only an ideological issue, it's also a danger to our society if we take an ultra-stringent, ultra-traditional view that we may make no innovation. Because when we innovate things that are permitted, but they didn't happen in the past because the sociological situation was different in the past, then we're permitting something which is permitted. And if we say that innovation is asur min haTorah, people will think that we're just forbidding them from just because of our whim. They won't think of us seriously. They won't take us as being truthful. And therefore, they also won't take us as being truthful when we forbid that which is forbidden. So now when we look at things that are happening in contemporary society, in contemporary Judaism, we'll take a couple of examples just to make things somewhat more clear. There is a new movement, and it's not clear if it's peripheral or whether it's becoming more central, within the modern Orthodox community, to give greater place for women within the synagogue ritual. Whether it's a question of women being called to the Torah, aliyot, nashim la Torah, whether it's a question of their being able to serve as cantors in parts of the service, which are tefillot yachid, personal prayers, as opposed to communal prayer, the two types of prayer. And other areas in which women could have greater degree of participation in synagogue ritual, because they feel that they're not being given a fair chance of expressing their own spirituality, but are being banished behind the mechitza. So if we can halachically justify, beyond all reasonable doubt, that these types of innovation because they didn't exist in the past, because sociologically women didn't know how to read, women weren't educated, women didn't even make these types of demands, they weren't aware of the fact that they were being discriminated against. If we can show that these things are really permissible, halachically, then what Rav Kook said is very applicable. And I'll tell you what he said by translating a very famous statement of his that came from a different halachic context. He said, it is not forbidden to permit that which is permitted, even though it didn't happen in the past. I repeat, it is not forbidden to permit that which is permitted, even though it didn't happen in the past. Innovation is something that didn't happen in the past. But if you're permitting something which is mutar min haTorah, which is permissible from a Torah point of view, then there's no reason to say chadash asur min haTorah. Recently, there's been something of a furore over the fact that a certain very learned lady was ordained and given a title, first of Maharat and then of Rabbah, titles which are not altogether very clear in their meaning. She was given a rabbinic ordination. She was tested by rabbis, I was one of them, and she was given a document which gave her the right to have certain halachic authority within the community. Now, this was immediately attacked, not only by the Ultra Orthodox, but by the RCA, which is meant to be sort of central modern Orthodox, but is moving towards the right, without any very clear justification. And it wasn't really an innovation, because women had been Roshei Kehila, they'd been halachic advisors, they'd been scholars in residence on a permanent status for years. There was no substantive change in this lady's status or position, and the discourse or the polemic was more about a title which constituted a danger to the establishment rabbinate. So suddenly we have a situation where women can be Supreme Court judges. In Israel, the head of the Supreme Court is a woman, a prime minister, an ombudsman, a president of also the CEO of some major corporation, but isn't allowed to have any sort of authority within the Jewish community. Now, does that make sense? Does it make sense that there should be a halachic ruling that a woman isn't allowed to be on a synagogue committee? I mean, it's almost funny. But that's part of the discourse, the halachic discourse of today. And when a woman was appointed to a Mo'etzah Datit in Israel some 10 or 15 years ago, that is to say to a rabbinic, to a religious committee as part of the municipality, then the Israeli rabbinate came out against it and said this was forbidden. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ratified the position. So women can be in all areas of leadership, political leadership, financial leadership, legal leadership, but not rabbinic leadership, not Jewish religious leadership, not synagogue leadership. You can understand that this doesn't make sense to many people. Many people find this is not a very rational situation. Let's take another case. Something which has again created a furore recently. But here it's more complex. In Jewish law, in most issues, there isn't a single view. Most issues are subject to discussion, to polemic discussion, to argumentation, from the Mishnah through the Talmud right down to the latest authorities. The Shulchan Aruch, as you know yourself, has a section that's written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, which is for Sfaradim, has alternative views for Ashkenazim by the Ramar, Moshe Isserlis, and the super commentaries give additional views. Now, it's very difficult for a person that's not within the field of halakha to know how to cope with a situation where, when you look at the codexes, the law books, you'll find such a variety of views. Well, how do you know which one to go according to? So the rules and regulations, they're called klalei apsak, the rules of how to make a halachic determination. An earlier authority and a later authority. The later authority is more to be followed. Yachid v'rabim, a single view as opposed to a majority view, we'll follow the majority view. And so on and so forth. So that we don't necessarily know what the absolute truth of a halakha is. We know how we have to relate to it, because there are these rules and regulations which tell us which particular opinion to follow. Now let's take a contemporary issue, and that's the issue of conversion. According to the Rambam, conversion is a relatively easy thing. You teach a person mitzvot, miktsat mitzvot kalot, or miktsat mitzvot chamurot. A few easy halachot and a few difficult ones. And then you have three hedyotot, three laymen who form a beit din and convert him or her. And then afterwards, one hopes he or she will continue to learn and find out the rest of the mitzvot and act accordingly. However, the Rambam continues, if after the process of conversion, a person chozer lesuro, becomes a mechalel Shabbos, the fahesia, eats treif, does all the other things which are absolutely forbidden, then he's a Jewish sinner. The chayavim b'hashavat avedato. And you have to regard him as a Jew, and if he loses something, you have to give it back to him. That's the formulation of the Rambam. There are even more liberal views that have been formulated from the early 20th century onwards. Chaim Eisner said that Chaim Eisner Gudzinski was one of the great poskim of the early 20th century, said that conversion, what is required is bitul avodah zarah, that you have to abrogate or negate your former religion and take upon yourself your willingness to be a Jew. Rav Uziel, who we quoted before, didn't even demand Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot, an open statement saying that I accept all the mitzvot. In fact, there's even a halachic problem involved, because according to the Gemara, you're not allowed to teach a non-Jew Torah. So as long as he's not converted, how can you teach him the halachot? This is a question that's, of course, dealt with. There are, on the other hand, certain opinions which are much more demanding and much more require a much greater degree of commitment. But there are virtually no views in classical halakha that state that a person that's been converted and then is not practicing as an Orthodox Jew should be practicing, or as a Jew should be practicing, can have his conversion retroactively annulled. Now, you are probably all aware of what happened in Israel not so long ago. The Beit Din in Ashdod had a certain particular case, and they declared that a woman who had believed that she had been converted and therefore her daughter was Jewish, the daughter wanted to get married, and she was no longer, according to the Beit Din, Shomeret Shabbat, a Sabbath observant woman. So the Beit Din declared that she was retroactively, her conversion was annulled. Consequently, her daughter was no longer Jewish, although she was born as a Jew. This was queried in the Supreme Rabbinic Court, which not only supported this ruling, but declared that all the conversions carried out by the court of Rav Drukman, and those of you who know of Rav Drukman know that he's a deeply pious religious Rosh Yeshiva and Rav and Talmid Chacham, they were all questioned. And in one particular statement that was made on an Erev Shabbat, publicly, in the media, on the Shabbat in which the Parsha of the week included the verse concerning Inui Hager, that you mustn't cause grief to a convert, all those thousands, tens of thousands of people suddenly didn't know if they were Jewish. And you can imagine a Shabbos table, sitting around the table on a Friday night, when a husband says, have I been living with a shiksa for the last 10 years? Are my children Jewish? Girls are on the verge of becoming married, don't know if they can get married. I mean, this was the most horrendous statement that could be possible. That created a tremendous amount of grief. I'm not talking of all the aveirot that these dayanim transgressed, of inui hager, of hachlama b'fam pumbi, of tzar, of boshet, and I could list a whole slew of them. But why were these dispositions taken? Because there happened to be some minority dissenting views which are more stringent. And do we have to choose them? Yes. Why do we have to choose them? Because if you don't know how to make a halachic determination, if you have a safek, an area of uncertainty, then in order to avoid making a real decision, you say it's asur. You say it's treif. So if there happens to be happen to be more than one opinion, and one is more lenient and one is more stringent, then isn't it safer to take the stringent position? And can you not justify it by saying that 500,000 questionable Jews that are living, Russian Jews that are living in Israel, will suddenly change the whole nature of Israeli society? Tell me when to finish. But if you believe that you have to preserve the nature of your tradition and the character of your religion as it was 50, 100 years ago, then of course such conversions, such changes will create the very character of your society. And that's a dangerous position to take. Therefore, it's easier to create a wall and a barrier and to alienate all these people. So we could give many more examples in different areas of marriage and divorce, of the aguna problem, or the so-called enchained women, or men, incidentally, and other areas, where the position of stringency, where the position of forbidding innovation, and the sort of innovation which is permissible, because it's based on halachic precedent, but it's chadash, asur min haTorah, and because it's challenging the traditional form of life, and because it may bring about some sort of a change in the very atmosphere in which you live. But I can fully understand that the Haredi community doesn't want to have televisions in their house. And I can fully understand that they claim that they don't want to have computers which have internet in their house. Because there are very many unacceptable influences that might affect the children and the next generation. But carte blanche to say that all innovation is unacceptable, forbidden, is something that runs counter to the very nature of traditional Jewish halakha. In every generation where there's been a serious challenge, sociological, economical, political, to the halakha, the great authorities, within the framework of normative halachic thinking, were able to find solutions. And I think we all know the classic examples of the Prosbol, which was a way that permitted people to continue to give loans to poor people, or interest. Ribbit is forbidden by the Torah, and yet we all have bank accounts, and all our economy depends upon receiving interest and earning money in this fashion. And we have to depend upon the so-called heteriska, which was developed in the 14th century. And there were others, when there were other serious challenges to Jewish society and to the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael, with the Shemitah problem, with the Jubilee problem, with the sabbatical year problem, solutions were found. And they were found within the parameters of halakha. And they were largely rejected by the ultra-traditionalists. They also are practical. I mean, they also have bank accounts. And they also receive ribbit. And they also use a heteriska. They don't depend upon the heter mechira, or the sabbatical year. They have other solutions. So what we tried briefly, and even somewhat superficially, to show is that there are two streams. There's a stream of rigidity. There's a stream of trying to preserve tradition in that unchanging fashion, which I personally believe is anti-halakha, anti-halakhic, and not in accordance with the traditions of halakhic thinking. And the mainstream of halakhic thinking, which is that the halakha, in order to be a Eitz Chaim, a Torah Chaim, a living Torah, can find ways of accommodating with the changes in society and face up to the challenges of modernity. Thank you.
Do we have time for questions? So if you have any, raise your hand and we'll go from there.
I'm just wondering how you fare with the Orthodox, and particularly the chief rabbi in Israel, because you're very, very liberal according to everything I read about them. Are you able to get along with them or meet with them or discuss situations?
Did I hear you say that the rabbinate in Israel is very liberal, or were you saying that I'm very liberal?
You're liberal.
I serve as an advisor to the Israeli rabbinate on a number of different issues, on interreligious issues, with in relationship with other religions, with Catholicism, with Anglicans, with Muslims, with Hinduism. We have constant dialogues with these people. So I know the Israeli rabbinate close up. And I disagree with almost everything that's going on in the Israeli rabbinate at a halachic point of view. And even more than that with the Batei Din, with the court. I think that what they are doing is alienating a great part of our centrist, modern Orthodox society. I think that it's a very strange and almost cynical situation where that organization, which is mandated by the government to deal with modern Orthodoxy, because the Haredim are not interested in the rabbinate, they have their own rabbis, and the Chilonim, the so-called secular Jews, also have really no interest in them. They have no need of them except at certain bureaucratic times, marriage, divorce, burial, when they're extremely alienated by the unfortunate bureaucracy that goes on. And it is the modern Orthodox society that really they should be serving, and they are just alienating them. And the modern Orthodox society now is becoming more and more disenchanted with what's going on. I have so many people that come to me and say, Rabbi, will you marry us? But we won't register with the rabbinate. Because the registration process in itself and the demands that are made. And of course, if there are questions of Jewish identity, it becomes even more problematic. I don't do it, because I explained to them that there will be other implications for their children that could be very damaging to them. But yes, I have a constant dialogue with them, and in certain areas we get on very well, and in other areas we disagree vehemently with one another. And it's not even that we disagree with one another. I think that to a large extent they agree with me. But they are subservient to the Haredi community for party political reasons. The decisions that are made by the Supreme Court of Religious Court of Israel are determined by Rabbi Yoshev and Rav Steinman, and not by those Dayanim themselves. And the Dayanim that are appointed because of their relationship either to the Lithuanian Gdolim, or to Rav Avadia and the Shas orbit, and not because of their personal ability as Talmidei Chachamim. And we know that This is something that's also been brought recently before the Supreme Court. So they have not the guts to think and to rule and to act independently. That is part of the politico-religious structure of the country, which is very difficult to deal with. So yes, I do have a good relationship with them, and they know that I have very severe criticisms of them. And of course, this has spilt over into the diaspora world too, in the relationships with the RCA, in the relationship with the Organization of European Rabbis, which is also losing its independence. There used to be independent bodies, even the British Rabbinate. You're the master of ceremony. The issue is somewhat more complex, as are all halachic issues. The questioner said that he has heard that women are not allowed to serve as witnesses in a rabbinic court.
Yeah.
And have there been any changes? Is this still the case? And so on and so forth. So I said the question is the issue is much more complex. The many different kinds of testimony. There isn't just one type of edut. There are many different types of edut. And for some of them, women can give witness, and for some they cannot. In point of fact, if we were to look at the list of possibilities of some 8 or 9 different types of classes of testimony, for the majority, a woman can give testimony. And more so, in cases which are very serious and crucial, a woman can give testimony. For example, a question of aguna. A husband vanished, and we don't know what happened to him. And his wife is enchained. She can't get married. You can receive a woman's testimony that she has seen that he died. For example, in questions of kashrut, a woman can give testimony. In other questions of isur v'heter, a woman can give testimony. A woman can give testimony in any type of testimony which will become evident in the future. But at the present moment, when the court needs to give a determination, the evidence is not available. A woman can give testimony. And so on and so forth. So there are areas where the halakha states very clearly that a woman cannot testify. And this is true in Israel, and this is true in any religious court. And there are many, many areas in which a woman can give testimony, does give testimony, is permitted to do so. And I would say that in most cases, a woman can give testimony. The question was, change is psychologically difficult. And we all know that making any serious change takes a great deal of courage and effort, and is also subject usually to social criticism and the additional elements that you didn't mention in the bringing about a change. So the question was, what happens, or how is it, what goes on in the egalitarian services, communities in Jerusalem, such as Shira Chadasha? But firstly, I'd like to slightly correct the formulation. Shira Chadasha is not an egalitarian service. It's what is normally called a partnership service. It doesn't give equal rights to women as to men in the synagogue service. It gives a certain areas of synagogue activities where women can participate. This is different to some new suggestions that have been recently made in the United States by certain individuals who have tried, who have suggested that there should be a complete egalitarian service where women and men can do equally every part of the service, and furthermore, where a minyan can be constituted by men and women, let's say five men and five women. That would be egalitarian. So Shira Chadasha is not that. Shira Chadasha does everything that is done in Shira Chadasha and in Dar Chinoam in New York, which is a sort of a sister community, you might call it, in accordance, according to their understanding, with the halakha, and in consultation with Rabbanim, with rabbinic authority. Now, it should be understood that these congregations and many other so-called partnership minyanim, which exist both in the United States and in Israel, and to a lesser extent in Europe, were all congregations that were born out of a mutual agreement of all parts of that community. They did not split existing communities. They did not suggest that they should take a vote in existing community. And if there are 51% that say that they want a partnership minyan, then the whole minyan should become partnership. There were groups of people that decided to constitute from scratch a new community. And normally they started in a incremental fashion. In other words, they started in a private house, maybe on a Friday night when there isn't Kriyat HaTorah, maybe once a month. And as they developed their own rules and regulations, because there isn't a Shulchan Aruch for partnership minyanim as yet, and as they became more and more popular, because they were satisfying a certain spiritual need for certain people that wanted it, and not everybody wants it. My own shul, for example, I find it very difficult, even on Simchat Torah, to give a Sefer Torah to a group of women to dance around. Even though they know that my view is that it's completely permissible. Doesn't work for them. As you said, psychologically it's very difficult for people to change. But on the other hand, there are young people, and there are people that feel, you know, they've studied in Michlalot, they're learned, and this is a new phenomenon of women in their thousands that learn Torah, and they learn Gemara, and they learn Halakha. And they have this spiritual need, and they want to have a greater degree of kiruv la Torah, of closeness. And they want an experience. You know, many synagogue services are very, very boring. And that's why people talk in the service and they talk about their stock exchange and their business. Or they talk Lashon Hara about their neighbors. I mean, it's good as a social gathering. It's not terribly spiritually uplifting. And it's usually too long. So you have to have a Kiddush in the middle and a Kiddush in the end so they should come. And Kriyat HaTorah, you can continue having your Kiddush so that you miss most of it, because that's also boring. Because you heard it last year. You heard it the year before. And then the servant, you're asleep. So when somebody started to decide to make a service that should be an experiential, spiritual experience, that interests people. That Karlbach was not accepted in his day. And now most minyanim, many, many minyanim, have adopted the sort of Karlbach tunes because it has a new vitality. So that's what Shira Chadasha is about. And Shira Chadasha is so full that you won't find a place to sit or to stand on a Friday night. They never advertised. There's a genuine need. Now, if this need is not being met, will not be met by the modern Orthodox community, then these people will go elsewhere. In New York, opposite the apartment of my daughter, I've got a daughter in New York, my daughter, is a big shul called BJ, Beit Bavei Yeshua. I guess it's a conservative synagogue. And in the summer when Shabbos comes in New York at 8 o'clock, they have a service that begins at 6 and they have another one at 7. And it's a pleasure for me to peep in through the door. There must be 1,000 people there. And the service is completely traditional in its liturgy, but they have a guitar and a drummer and women and men together, and there's such joy. And all these people, if they wouldn't be in DJ, they'd be on the streets. And all the people in Shira Chadasha, if Shira Chadasha or Dar Chinom didn't exist, would be in BJ. So that BJ is not permitted. That's not permitting the permissible. Or Chaim and Dar Chinom and Shira Chadasha is permitting the permissible. It's true, it's innovative. It's saving Jews. It's bringing them back into the orbit of what we would call centrist modern Orthodox Judaism. No, I said exactly the opposite. I said that in my own synagogue, I find it difficult because the women are not willing to take a Sefer Torah and to dance. It's only the young kids, the young girls will do it. First of all, it's not mainstream because it's new and it takes time for new things to develop. I don't know what will be in 10 years' time. In 10 years' time, it may be mainstream. We don't know. I'm not a futurist. But I would say as follows. I'm not comfortable davening in a Teimani Minyan. I'm not comfortable davening in a Moroccan Minyan. Why? Because there's a different accent, different tunes. It's not what I was brought up in. Each person chooses where to daven and how to daven according to what satisfies his own spiritual need. So there's never been a unity or a uniformity of liturgy and of prayer and of synagogue service. This has never been the case. And here we have a new type of service, which at the moment is only sporadic and only in few synagogues. But it is just another example of the possible pluralistic abilities of the Jewish community to satisfy spiritual needs. Those people who say, it's halachically beseder aval zel sepastnisht, it's not suitable, are expressing exactly what Mrs. Twain said. Psychologically, they're not attuned, they're not ready for it. If it develops, if it takes on, and the truth is that, you know, 10 years ago there was perhaps only one or two such minyanim. Now, although you may not be aware of it, there are hundreds of them. They're not, many of them, most of them are not in synagogues. Most of them are either in private houses or in Israel in matnasim or in schools, because the synagogue, the rabbinate is not going to give them a place. Again, because the rabbinate sees this as a chadash asur min haTorah. But when this becomes broader, if it becomes not peripheral, but more central, people become attuned to it. And it just takes time. But I think that the basic thing that people have to understand is that it is halachically permissible. And if it's halachically permissible, and if it's not damaging, if it's not hurting people, then it should be encouraged. And let me just, I know the time is late, but let me just give you one example. In temple times, a person that brought an offering used to place his hand on that offering, on a cow or a calf, a sheep, and that was called smicha. And that was a part of the ritual. Now, according to the halakha, biblical law, a woman is not allowed to do smicha. Why? They learned it from psukim. But the Gemara states that the rabbis permitted women to do smicha kedei la'asot nachat ruach lenashim, to give pleasure and satisfaction to women. Now, I feel absolutely certain that there wasn't a suffragette movement in the time of the Second Temple that chained themselves to the gates of the temple and said, "We want to do smicha." There was no such thing. There may have been individual women that said, "You know, we would like to have greater participation. We're giving the sacrifice." There couldn't have been many of them, because very few men, women brought that type of sacrifice. A yoledet, for example, somebody that had a child, would bring a bird, b'sach hakol. You don't do smicha on birds, on kinim. But the rabbis were aware of the fact that there was a certain desire on the part of some women, maybe few women, to have a greater degree of participation. It's they that are bringing this korban nedava, this of their own free will. And so they permitted it. And they found their justification. And in later halacha, we find additional examples of things that were permitted to women which had apparently been forbidden before, kedei la'asot nachat ruach lenashim. So, I think that that's the way we have to think how halakha should work. Halakha has to give nachat ruach, not just to nashim, also to men. It has to be friendly, it has to be inclusive. It has to make you appreciate and love the Torah and appreciate its values and not push you away. It was Shammai Hazakein that pushed away the person that came and wanted to be a ger, Ba'amat Achoma. Hillel accepted him. I'm sure that the present rabbinate would not have accepted any of Hillel's converts.
Once again, thank you very much, Dr. Sperber. Thank you, Sheila and Lou, for sponsoring. I don't know if everyone... Yeah, they deserve a hand. If anyone's interested in learning more about Dr. Sperber's positions on these and other issues, you could go to Amazon.com, type in the word Daniel Sperber, and his available books in English will come up. Most recently, Dr. Sperber published a book on life cycle, published by Bar-Ilan together with Oxford University, and another volume, which is an expansion of that one, is coming out as well. which includes a lot of the Hebrew material, which may be inaccessible to some of us. So that's a great way to learn more from Dr. Sperber. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. Please continue to have refreshments outside or continue your conversation with Dr. Sperber here. Laila Tov.